Mayor Curry joins Governor Scott in expressing concern about Syrian refugees. The community has a conversation about the city's human rights ordinance and a big summit in Jacksonville on criminal justice reform. We'll tell you why the big talker was on banning the box and what that means. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and now. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. Then later, Top Chef winner Kevin Sobraga on his new restaurant in town. Plus, don't miss the live in-studio performance later in the show from local singer-songwriter Katie Grace Hilo. All of that ahead this morning, but first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly roundtable here today. Ron Littlepage of the Florida Times-Union, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Good to see you. Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner, is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to see you again.
And Matt Shaw, editor at Folio Weekly.
Hi, Melissa.
Guys, always great to see you, and thanks so much for being with us. Plenty of news from the week to discuss, from that Operation Reform Summit looking at criminal justice issues to a new poll showing Donald Trump still leading in Florida among all 2016 contenders on both sides of the aisle, and more headlines. But first this morning, our top story, Mayor Lenny Curry joining with Florida Governor Rick Scott and more than half the nation's governors. He sent a letter to Senator Marco Rubio and the rest of this local congressional delegation around Jacksonville asking that Congress stop a plan to accept any more Syrian refugees. Now, the move comes in the wake of the terror attacks in Paris that left 129 people dead. Curry says in a letter he does understand the need to be compassionate about incoming refugees, but that public safety is his top priority. The White House plan calls for accepting 10,000 refugees nationwide fleeing war in Syria. Jacksonville has the fifth largest Syrian population in the U.S. This discussion comes as this morning we learned gunmen have stormed a luxury hotel in the capital of Mali, killing at least three people and taking about 170 hostages. It's in a city that serves as a logistics hub for French forces helping in the fight against Islamist insurgents. No immediate claim of responsibility there. We want your calls on this top story. Give us a call with your thoughts at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet the show. Fred Matthews, Mayor Curry, saying that his concern arose in part because a Syrian passport was found at the scene of the terror attack in Paris. There is still some uncertainty, however, as to whether that was a fake. This has generated quite a bit of discussion around town, especially given the fact that we have such a large Middle Eastern population here in Jacksonville. Your thoughts this morning?
Well, Mayor Curry's joining in the chorus was understandable. It's happening from the U.S. Congress on down. The number of governors who announced that they would somehow ban Syrian refugees from coming to the countries. You can imagine the scene of having the highway patrol at the Georgia-Florida border and the Georgia-Alabama border checking IDs to see who would come into their state, who is it, who is not. And the concern is understandable. But again, from a mayor's standpoint, and especially from a Jacksonville mayor's standpoint, where we have such a long history of Syrian Americans who live here, who work here, who contribute to this country and who have relatives over there, It begins to make accusations that somehow they might be involved in this. And then we hearken back to what happened to the Japanese in World War II, when they were all rounded up, taken to one point in the country and held there while Japanese Americans were serving in the U.S. Armed Forces in World War II. Imagine the sight. So we must not let terrorism do its work, and that's apparently what terrorism is doing here. It's doing its job.
Matt.
I find it a little surprising that that the mayor would come out on this. It's not surprising to see some of the Republican presidential candidates sort of overreact to what was a tragedy in Paris. But there is a fairly scrutinous system in place to screen refugees from Syria, and President Obama has asked for the country to accept more. 10,000, I think, is the number, but that would be from what I understand, 18,000 applicants. And so at the rate that they have been going at, it's less than 50%, I think, make it past that process and are actually accepted into the country. Most of those are widows and orphans. And I think the number of men of combat age that are accepted is something like 2% of the refugees accepted into the country.
We'll go to your calls on this topic in a moment at 549-2937. Ron Littlepage, Travis Trice with World Relief, appearing on this program yesterday, said in the entire history of the refugee resettlement program in America, with 3 million refugees placed from around the world, there's never been a terrorist among that group. It was interesting to see on our First Coast Connect Facebook page yesterday, I think it's probably the most commented topic we've ever had on our Facebook page in the history of this program. One commenter said, in reacting to Travis's remarks, well, so what if there's never been an incident? There were never terrorists that flew planes into skyscrapers before September 11th. We can't look backward. We have to anticipate the unexpected and the never-befores when we look at this global threat. So the mindset of many folks right now is, I think, one of fear and defensiveness. What are your thoughts?
Well, the main problem I have is that fear is being played on by politicians, and they are doing it purposely. Governor Scott among them, which is why it's disappointing that Mary O'Curry jumped into this. If you look at what Governor Scott said, he was wrong. Now, that's not surprising, but he was wrong. Matt Dixon of Politico reported this week that the 425 number that he's been using of Syrian refugees that Obama is going to send to Florida is made up of out of thin air. The 425 number came from settlement groups here in Florida who said they could handle that many refugees from not just Syria but from all over, and Obama administration has not assigned any number to any place. So, you know, you start off with a bad number, and it's just a built, preys on people's fears, and that's a shame.
Tim Gibbons.
I find interesting about a lot of the commentaries, it seems to be utterly unaware of Jacksonville's history in accepting refugees. And from a security standpoint, that's a meaningful thing. Not simply that an attack hasn't happened, but these are people who, you know, spend their lives dedicated to helping people come here and assimilate and become part of the community. Quite honestly, I if you want to talk about refugees on a national scale, there's just like a political conversation there. Looking practically locally, these are people who, you know, again, have devoted their lives to helping people come in. That actually makes me feel safe, you know, the idea that we have these vetted people who are being helped to assimilate.
549-2937. Let's go to Dave along I-95 right now. Hello, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning. Listening to the news, all I can think of is, what a bunch of cowardly wimps Republicans are, turning tail and running anytime anything seems the least bit threatening. I'm just frankly disgusted by hearing local politicians completely disregard our American heritage of welcoming and greeting foreigners, because after all, we are a nation of immigrants. And so to take the stance that just because there is one or less than 1% chance that someone might cause some kind of mayhem, that we all of a sudden turn our backs on widows and orphans, come on, that's just plain disgusting. And I'm surprised that anybody can tolerate that kind of talk from Americans.
That's Dave along I-95. Speaker Paul Ryan this week on Capitol Hill is assuring reporters that new legislation assembled in the wake of the Paris attacks, Fred, isn't about keeping Muslims out of the country. It's about national security.
It is about keeping Muslims out of the country. I mean, you can call it whatever you want to call it. But I mean, with all of the rhetoric that's taken place in the presidential campaigns and all of the targeting toward persons of the Islamic faith as being attached to this, I mean, that's what it's about. They're the only group we're looking at right now. But again, all of this, it is, as I think Congresswoman Corrine Brown used the word, it is a knee-jerk reaction to this. And it is what politicians do. I mean, it's not surprising. surprising. This is what they do. It's a crisis. You have to have something to say. They're all rolling out refugee and terrorist plans this week. We'll see them all in the rhetoric that's coming forth. It's what it's all about. And again, this is also masking and will further kill any efforts toward an immigration proposal for this country. It's going to kill it. We're not going to have any more discussion. Talk about a wall over Mexico. All of a sudden, Mexico is not important because apparently we don't have any terrorists coming from there. And, of course, it denies all of the issues we've seen. Where have we gotten most of the domestic terrorism from? Folks who were born and raised right here. Need we forget about Oklahoma? Should we forget about the other places that have occurred? Those are homegrown terrorists that were born and raised right here. But all that, put that aside. We've got to stop this mass, this huddled mass, from coming here.
I think this is the thing that surprised me the most about the mayor stepping out and making these statements. This is silly season in politics. I expect to come up, you know, honestly, whatever side you're on, I expect a national conversation to happen on this. It seems odd to me that this would be an issue that the mayor feels that, you know, behind pensions and the HRO and what happens with downtown and the list of everything else that, you know, the couple dozen Syrian refugees who might come here is, as he said, a main priority. That seems unusual to me.
Here's an email from Hank in Fernandina Beach. What are they afraid a refugee will do? Go into a public place and shoot strangers? That happens somewhere in the U.S. about once a week. This is a panic reaction by spineless politicians, he writes. Here are lots of tweets coming into the show. Mandy tweets the show. In France, they are accepting 30,000 Syrian refugees despite the attacks on Paris. Matt, Ron, what would you say to listeners who think that's a mistake?
Well, I want to follow up with what Tim said. That I feel more comfortable when we have a settlement program that works with these refugees and makes them easier to assimilate into our society and learn about it and become part of it. They're less likely to be radicalized if they're not placed in some kind of camp and set there for 3 or 4 years where they're easy to bring into the ISIL fold. So that makes me actually feel better bringing them in and making them part of our community.
Right, and we have abundant resources in this country too to make that transition. I guess go as smooth as possible, rather than we're spending tons of money right now just bombing places that the fallout of that creates a lot of terrorism too. So I mean, we have the resources to make this a smooth process.
549-2937, Clinton on the West Side. Clinton, good morning to you.
Good morning. I hope you guys are having a wonderful day. You know, I feel very uncomfortable when anyone compare what is going on with the situation that happened in with the Japanese being interred, because it's totally, totally different. There's nothing that can be compared to that. And pretty much that's all I had to say.
All right, Clinton, thanks for the call. Although I would point out there have already been calls for internment. They're not being taken seriously, I don't think, by anyone. But I have seen those calls online.
Yeah,
Matt.
And some of the presidential candidates on the Republican side, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, have talked about all Muslims registering as such.
I was reading Snopes, the online, you know, debunking sort of thing, and it was referring to some comments that Trump had made, which seemed Hitler-esque, and it referred to them as being mostly false, which they are, and that's a
right.
good thing. But it's an interesting point in our public discourse where Hitler-esque comments could be deemed mostly false. You know, that's even
mostly,
a conversation.
Fred, what do you
unusual.
Think about the Clinton's remark that he doesn't think it's a fair comparison?
Well, I mean, that's his opinion, but the fact of the matter is that we were scared, and we took action. We rounded up people who were good citizens, paid their taxes, citizens of this country, mind you, not Japanese. They were citizens. Their sons were serving in the military. Some of the sons joined while their family was interred here by one of our most favored presidents, I might mind you, and America did nothing. And it wasn't until 60 years later that we finally decided to say that we were sorry to these families who had suffered so much with this. It's not that far away, folks. for this to occur if we're not careful. But those of us who are educated about what's happening and know the history and have Syrian friends and relatives and people we do business with and understand the work of Lutheran Social Services here on this level, who works with refugees day in and day out, and the group you had on the air the other day, understand what's going on and how difficult it is, as Ron has indicated, how difficult it is to become, to get here, let alone become a citizen of the United States.
And when we talk about, Ron, when we talk about Jacksonville having the fifth largest Syrian population in the United States, it's important, I think, to recognize that a lot of these families are second and third generation. Syria and Lebanon used to be all one big entity. A lot of these families came over with the decline of the Ottoman Empire, and some names you might recognize are now leading citizens of Jacksonville who are of Syrian or Lebanese or Palestinian descent, like Tony Slaman, the owner of The Landing, State Attorney Angela Corey, former news anchor Donna Deegan, City Councilman Tommy Hazuri, Rick Mullaney, former mayoral candidate, is half Syrian. I could name many, many more. I'm sure yes. All of you could as well.
And I grew up with them in my neighborhood. They owned a community store at the corner, which I went up to get kerosene every day. His store and his children have gone on to be major lawyers in this community. So, I mean, we have to understand what we're talking about, folks. They have relatives in Syria who are trying to get through this.
Yeah. Let's go to Sean quickly in Jacksonville. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi. I appreciate the comments, particularly that Fred and you have pointed out, which is we have a strong Syrian presence in our city who have contributed mightily to Jacksonville's success. I strongly object to some of your guests' emotional use of Hitlerism and such as that. My main concern is that we have a significant group of people who are grossly underserved in our community right now, not just homeless veterans, but homeless in general. And I would like to hear what your guests have to say about addressing those immediate ongoing needs that have existed in Jacksonville for some time before we address the idea of assimilating more folks into our community.
Sean, thanks for the call, and you're right. Although there are several groups working to bring the homeless count in this community down to zero, that is an ongoing effort, and efforts to bring the number of homeless veterans in Jacksonville down to zero have actually made quite a bit of progress. We did a segment on that on this program just a few weeks ago. Two Syrian families have been admitted in calendar year 2015 to Jacksonville. I learned that just the other day. And it's likely that there would probably be no more than a trickle for the next 6 months to a year. So while I agree with you that that is a very valid concern, I think the numbers don't really bear out that we're dealing with an overwhelming number of folks when we're looking at those two different populations. Let's take another quick call. It's Justin in Palatka. Hi, Justin.
Hi. I just had a comment. I keep hearing your guests talk about how that all the refugees and everything are widows and orphans. Was it not one of the Paris terrorist attack, a woman that blew herself up in the motel building? And then just one more comment is that we have enough problems in America. We don't need to create more problems for ourselves. We just need to mind our own business and take care of the homeland.
That's Justin in Palatka. Matt Shaw.
To the first point, I'm not really sure how to respond to that. There was a woman, or reports say that there was a woman, but I'm not sure how that relates to letting widows and orphans in as refugees. And to the point of taking care of ourselves, I think it's part of our national ideals to show compassion in situations like this. And when we have the resources to do it, I think you step up and you do it. So,
Cody in Ortega is on the line. Hi, Cody. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say how sad I found it that this has turned into such a controversy. You know, America was built on immigrants. So for us to refuse so many that need our help in this time, I think is pointing to a sad direction of where we're going. And to everybody talking about the homeless and all of that, you know, where were they 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago? It's just it's a way to turn the conversation away from what's their own bigotry, and I think that needs to stop.
Let's take one more call. It's Dave in St. Augustine. Hello, Dave.
Hey, good morning. I just want to comment about the politicians of a certain ilk raising this issue is no surprise. What really kind of disturbs me is how quick to embrace this sort of false moral outrage has been. That more than 50%, apparently, polls are showing of Americans agree that they should put a halt to this immigration. And I'm wondering if this is just, you know, playing it. Why do you think people are so quick to identify with this fear? And is it tapping into the same dynamic that it kind of informs a lot of public debate these days, that kind of is veiled racism, perhaps? There's so much information out there about how long it takes to go through the refugee settlement program. It can take years. And these people are not just, you know, coming in with carte blanche. And there are other sort of travel visa issues that are far more important to address. That, you know, anyone who wants to come in as a terrorist is not going to go through a 2-year process to sneak in as a refugee. So that's all I have to say.
Yeah. Thank you, Dave.
Are out there, you know, and just why do you think people are so quick to embrace it?
Thank you,
so
Dave. It has been pointed out that the majority of Americans polled are in favor of halting or slowing the refugee process. Fred.
Well, that's understandable. And if you can recall, not more than 2 months ago, I think the president was only bringing in about 7,000, a year or something like that. And then he got jumped on because that was too few. They said, you got to bring in more. Everybody else is bringing in more. And the president says, okay, but we have a process to go through. So a few more are coming through. But no more are going to come through than our process allows. We're simply not. The process is difficult. I mean, there have been countless stories now that it can take up to 18 months or 2 years to get here while you're going through the vetting process. So we already have a process in place. It's pretty tough, except for those people who may be in a dire situation where we may bring them here. And even then, they're being watched almost 24/7 while they're in this country. But nobody's getting in here just so. And besides, we've got two oceans on either side. And if you want to walk across the Bering Strait at the top of the world to get down America, you probably need to be here.
Ron.
Fred raises a very good point. There's a lot disturbing about this conversation and debate. One of them, which is, if you ask many people in this country, they probably think there's no vetting process to have refugees comes in. Our House of Representatives adds to that by saying we need rules, so we need to vet people. We are doing that. We've been doing that. But if you say that enough, as they're doing, people believe that. That is, to tell for me how far this conversation has gone off track is Jeb Bush, who could be considered a moderate among the presidential candidates from the Republican Party, has come out and said we should only allow Christians to come in as refugees.
I believe he later walked that back.
Yeah, do you walk that back?
And speaking of Jeb Bush and the rest of the Republican field, Donald Trump will appear in Sarasota next week. The GOP presidential candidate tops the latest Florida poll, comfortably ahead of all other challenges in the Republican 2016 field. Polls show he would also beat Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton in Florida if the election were held today. Trump this week saying he would consider shutting down mosques as president to fight terror. Tim Gibbons.
It's an interesting thing for the Republican Party to have gone through months, and we've had this conversation here. Well, you know, once people start paying attention and once the everything, you know, just goes on through the process, well, you know, Trump is one of these just kind of early process sort of candidates. But clearly he is tapping into a part of the Republican Party who strongly supports him, and, you know, he's not going to go away anytime soon.
Matt Shaw, the chairman of the Trump campaign, Joe Gruters, the co-chair, by the way, is Jacksonville's own Susie Wiles, said his candidate is building a strong operation in Florida, on track to deny either Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush, the two hometown sons, a victory on their home turf. And at this point, it looks as though they might have a path to victory in the winner-take-all March Florida primary.
Yeah, I think it is still early, and I know we've had this conversation like months ago. We talked about this when Donald Trump was first leading. But right now, to me, he sort of seems to like he's holding this position, and any time a new person comes up next to him, he just serves to decimate that person in the Republican Party. Ben Carson is an example. Jeb Bush was the first example. And, you know, he may serve that role during this early part of the primary season as we get closer. But I still think that somebody like Marco Rubio, who has his flaws as well, but can appeal to a broader base.
But remember, the Republican Party actually has changed its primary process trying to get this like clear. They didn't want this bruising, sure, you know, dragging on primary. So it's actually set up to have, you know, an early winner get the nomination. And
sure,
when you look at think pieces with unnamed party leadership on the GOP side talking about their prospects for the general election, there's a lot of hand wringing about Donald Trump, Ron. Concern about him as a general election nominee.
There should be. There should be a concern about a number of the Republicans running for office. I'm going to stick to my earlier position. This is November. I will start paying attention after the New Hampshire vote. I'm not going to pay attention to Iowa because that's a weird setup. But New Hampshire,
did you just insult Iowa? The entire state of Iowa?
I just said that it's a weird setup. But I'll start paying attention and after New Hampshire. And I'm still a firm believer that Trump bottoms out at the most at 30%. So,
Fred.
Well, I think Ron's right. I mean, we're about to approach a dead zone in campaigning here. One week from today after this, nothing's going to happen. The legislatures all across the country are done. Congress won't be talking. The president will be someplace else. The media will be scrambling to give us happy news. The campaign will not be a big deal until we come back the second or third day of January. But I got to tell you, you know, unless something really drastically changes, which will be the primary, Donald Trump is becoming real here. He's becoming real to a lot of folks in the Republican Party. And because of this winner-take-all philosophy, they adopted, okay, their own constituency is looking hard at it. Marco Rubio is their best hope for some civility, but he's third back in the pack. And he's not making great inroads up there in the New England states.
That's my point, is that let's say Donald Trump takes Florida with all of Florida's electoral votes and delegates. That gives Donald Trump, if he takes a few other primary states, a real run at the nomination.
We've talked many times on this show about the true divisions in the body politic, and this idea that, you know, we have two electorates and that the number of moderates is just dwindling. This is a sign of this, the idea that you could have a Republican Party, at least a good chunk of the Republican Party, very happy with Trump as a candidate, and a bunch of people who are aghast at that, you know, on the Democratic side. And that is going to make for an interesting general election.
549-2937. We want your calls. It's our Friday Media Roundtable as we discuss the top stories of the week with Ron Littlepage, Fred Matthews, Tim Gibbons, and Matt Shaw. Mayor Lenny Curry hosting the first of three community conversations this week on whether Jacksonville should expand its anti-discrimination laws to cover LGBT people. An overflow crowd turned out to listen, ask a few questions, and debate over this 1 hour and 45-minute town hall meeting. It was moderated, by the way, by our own WJCT CEO, Michael Boylan. Ron Littlepage, you have a column about this in today's Florida Times Union. The two sides really sort of in the same camps they were back in 2012, the pro and cons on this very divisive issue here in Jacksonville.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the same arguments are for and against are being made once again. If anybody paid attention 3 years ago when it was before the city council, heard the same things, that is not going to change. We're going to have two more of these so-called community conversations. The same people are going to show up. They're going to make the same arguments. And here we are. So if I said in my column this morning, if the mayor really wanted to save people time, he could just gone back and watch the videos of the city council meeting and heard all the same things. But this is the process that's been set up. We're going to have to get down and decide whether this city is going to be inclusive of all of its citizens or it's not. And that's going to be the bottom line.
Fred Matthews, the Reverend R.L. Gundy, switched his position recently on this. The faith community, some prominent leaders are now coming around on the expansion side.
Well, I think it's good that that Pastor Gundy did that. You know, he still took some flack because of it. He'd apparently already become a consultant to the group doing it, and you know that always throws a little mud on your you know change of heart. But he is a well-known guy and respected in the religious community, certainly within the Black Baptist community and so forth. I mean, you know, I think you know again, you know, Ron's right. I mean. Let's get this matter proposed. Either Hazuri is going to propose the bill this time around, and we can get it on the council agenda. Let's not drag this out. Right. Either you are or you aren't, okay? I mean, it's just that simple. And if you aren't, fine. Jacksonville can probably live with it.
Yeah. Matt.
I think it's easy for us in media who've been sort of following this story to say that and say, let's get this thing over with and go. But I think there's still questions of whether or not Mayor Curry is just taking a pragmatic approach to this. If he really is listening to these conversations, or he's just put them in place to seem like he is bringing people to the table, which he'll eventually just support this thing in the long run.
Well, to give the administration the benefit of the doubt, they've convened three community-wide meetings. Let's be fair here.
It was a campaign promise.
He followed through on a campaign promise. Tim Gibbons.
There is a sense that, I mean, an editorial this week in the Business Journal basically saying that the point of these conversations is the only mind that needs to be changed, if it has to be changed, is Lenny Curry's. You know, everybody else who's showing up has a position one way or the other. The mayor has come out against discrimination, but has not seen the need for an HRO expansion.
Right.
So the question is, it's going to come up before council. It appears that the council has the votes to pass it. Is he going to veto it or not? Or is he going to work behind the scenes, as it's possible that Alvin Brown did, to have it not even come to his desk? So the point of these conversations is, where does the mayor come out at the end of it?
Tigger, driving along I-10.
Wow.
Hi, Tigger. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
You know, they always say, be a Tigger, not an Eeyore. So I bet you are,
I'm
too.
I'm the only one. So maybe it's LGBTF, lesbian, gays, et cetera, and Syrians. Ultimately, the mayor is swapping coasts here, where he's allowing one and not the other. I mean, what's the case?
Ron Littlepage.
Does he want the mayor's position on bringing in gay Syrians? Exactly.
All right.
So I guess his larger point is, are we an inclusive, welcoming city, or aren't we?
I think the point there is whether the mayor's really leading on this issue. I mean, convening community conversations when the general counsel already did a study that said discrimination exists in the city, and that we should, we're the largest city that doesn't have such an ordinance. Not anymore, I guess. Houston is.
Yeah. Well, actually, yes. Now, this is all taking place, Ron, in the wake of Houston making national headlines for rolling back its ordinance that had these protections, and it saw a very high-profile campaign that became known as the Bathroom Ordinance. Critics called it a scare campaign, where opponents of this ordinance said that transgender people would be going into the wrong bathroom.
Tim, you thought I insulted Iowa. I've lived in Houston. I can tell you those people are crazy. In the campaign that was mounted, once again, played to fears. You know, if you want to defeat something, you go out and say something that can be off the wall, but people who are afraid hear that. And this came up in the meeting this week on the community conversation. Those opposed started off trying to be, well, you know, we're a receptive community, we're a friendly community. By the time the conversation ended, they were bringing up the bathrooms, and the one I particularly like, what if a white guy decides he wants to be African-American? You know, what's to prevent that
from
happening?
Wait, we don't have different bathrooms anymore for that.
Besides, a white guy did try that once back in the 50s.
Either of you would probably know more than I. Has there actually been any documented case of anywhere that does have a human rights ordinance of a transgender, of a male going into a female restroom for nefarious reasons? I mean, I haven't seen it. I would assume it would have been.
It happens now all the time. You know, it doesn't stop anybody, a guy from putting on a dress and going into a bathroom if he's so inclined.
Yeah, and the greater question, I don't think we have a law against that. I mean, if you want to use a restroom, you can use a public restroom. The issue is whether or not you are going to be accused of, what was it,
indecent
exposing yourself. Yeah, indecent exposure. Yeah. I mean, you know, come on. The mayor is doing a good thing here. He is fulfilling a campaign promise, and that is to listen to folks. The business community is on board with this. The council understands what they need to do. This is part of the process of making everybody feel they've been heard. Essentially that. It is his administration. I would tend to think that he won't work like behind the scenes or not work behind the scenes as a former mayor did. He's not hugging the cross on this matter. So I would tend to think that we'll just have to labor through this, Ron, and get everybody on board.
And here's a tweet coming in right now from the Jacksonville Coalition for Equality. Local opposition leaders are trying to turn our HRO into a bathroom bill. We will not allow it, they tweet the show. So
there's an interesting bit, and Ron, you've written a little bit about this with the mayor, his recent comments about the liberal media and, you know, evangelizing for conservatism. The mayor's in an interesting position where, you know, he has some of his biggest business community supporters strongly support expanding the HRO. The business-minded Mayor Curry,
and
clearly,
the business community is giving the mayor political cover.
He is, but when you look at the things like the Syrian refugee things and his comments to the Republican, you know, convention, you end up with which Mayor Curry is it? Is it the politician or the businessman?
Speaking of the mayor, a busy week for him as he joined a slew of other panelists this week to discuss criminal justice issues at the Operation Reform Summit in downtown Jacksonville. Among the topics discussed, one known as Ban the Box. That's a national movement that would not make it mandatory for companies to ask a potential new employee whether they have a criminal record. Matt Shaw, this is something that a bipartisan group of players at this event now say that could go a long way toward helping ex-offenders leaving prison find jobs and stop the revolving door of people going in and out of the criminal justice system.
Sure. We've been talking about a lot of divisive issues and a lot of things that are kind of, you know, dividing the country. But this one with the banning the box and inmate reentry programs is something that is having is gaining support on both sides of the aisle. And it's a really important issue, and it's nice to see a local organization kind of leading a national charge for this.
Yeah, and Fred and Ron, Mayor Curry joining the mayor of Tallahassee, a lot of other national figures in this movement, all in Jacksonville for this event.
Yeah, I would dare say with one in five of us, and in some cases one in three of us having some sort of criminal record, this is a big deal. And yeah, at this table. So it's a big deal. And you consider the huge incarceration rate we have here in Florida, this could put a lot of folks, at least give them the opportunity to get to work, whereas right now, particularly in the retail industry or in warehousing industry, mm-hmm. they can't get jobs because of this.
Yeah. And Ban the Box actually has gotten some really big business support of them basically saying, you know, we're looking for qualified workers, but we need cover to do this because if we're the only ones who, you know, don't have it, it becomes a thing.
Yeah.
I think it's important if this shows you, if you really want to get bipartisan corporation, a good thing to do is focus on economics. You know, people say it is a lot cheaper to have people working in our community rather than being housed in prisons. And maybe that's the way we need to approach many of these divisive issues.
Now that the president has come out in favor of this legislation, I'm assuming that now will become a divisive thing.
That's true.
Well, speaking of criminals, we're going to turn our attention to the antics of South Florida right now as we discuss our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. Now, only in Florida does a public official try to pay a huge fine with small change. The Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics and Public Trust sued Hialeah Mayor Carlos Hernandez for trying to pay a $4,000 fine with 28 buckets of pennies and nickels. The commission also doubled the fine imposed on Hernandez, saying he intentionally broke the rules by sending the 360,000 coins, even though he knew the panel accepts only checks.
Whoa.
The mayor calls
so he violated the law.
Yes. The mayor calls the complaints against him a political circus and describes members of the commission as clowns. They ruled in July that Hernandez lied to citizens in both Spanish and English about his charge of usurious interest rates on a $180,000 loan to jewelry salesman Luis Felipe Felipito Perez, who is jailed in a massive pyramid scheme fraud.
Legal tender fraud, that's public and private. It says it right on there.
And only in Florida do Bigfoot hunters refer to the elusive creature as the skunk ape, right? But in Florida, they also claim to have real video evidence. David Sedati of Lakeland is the leader of the Independent Sasquatch Research Team. Now, he recognizes that he and others face skepticism, if not outright derision, when they talk about the existence of giant hairy creatures that have somehow evaded any conclusive detection for centuries. Sedati says even his wife is skeptical about the creatures he has spent countless hours pursuing in the woods of Central Florida. But now Sedati and one of his team members say they've changed minds. They have captured video of what they believe to be the actual skunk ape, or swamp ape, as it's also called here in Florida. You can check it out for yourself.
Is he a refugee?
Their YouTube
probably came through our Porsche barters.
Their YouTube channel, The Trail to Bigfoot, is online, and it has garnered more than 10,000 views.
Wow.
Thanks to our media panel, Tim Gibbons, Matt Shaw, Ron Littlepage, and Fred Matthews. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And up next, Top Chef winner Kevin Sabraga.
Join WJCT December 15th at the WJCT Studios as we celebrate the final season of Downton Abbey with a cocktail reception and a sneak preview of Season 6. Reception begins at 6:30 with the preview event to begin at 7:30. Tickets are $30 and include a chance to win a Downton weekend at Sea Island. Costumes are optional but encouraged. More info at wjct.org/events or 358-6327.
Some folks are really dedicated to trying out new recipes.
So they weren't Doritos, they were homemade Doritos.
What? Wait, dial it back. So are you serious?
They were actually homemade Doritos.
The men behind the blog The Bitten Word have ideas for your Thanksgiving table. Tex-Mex green bean casserole, anyone? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, the sounds of New Orleans will fill the Ritz Theater and Museum tomorrow night as the Dirty Dozen Brass Band performs for one show only. The seven-member ensemble has a global following, and they've been featured on the HBO series Tremé. Singer and soprano sax player Roger Lewis says their sound is just like the amazing city they call home, a real mix of cultures all thrown into one pot.
Well, you know, you could expect high energy, you know, something for your mind, your body, and your soul. You ever been to New Orleans? Well, you know, we got this dish called gumbo. And gumbo, you got a little bit of everything in it, right? New Orleans is a very cultural city, and we got all, you know, we have Italians, we got Germans. There's a melting pot of different cultures, you know. And you put them all in a pot, and it come out, and it tastes so good musically, you know what I mean? So I always say our music is it's like a pot of gumbo. You got everything in the gumbo, you got everything in the music, because you got all these different cultures, you know.
That's the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. They're at the Ritz Theater for one show only. It's tomorrow night in downtown Jacksonville. Tickets at jacksevents.com. And we regret to say singer Katie Grace Hilo couldn't make it this morning. So finally, this hour, foodies across the First Coast rejoiced last week when Sabraga & Company, the newest restaurant from celebrated chef Kevin Sabraga, officially opened in the new Unity Plaza. The new place takes advantage of waterfront views and the communal spirit of the park in the historic Brooklyn neighborhood. Sabraga's cuisine takes a contemporary approach to the cultural influences of Northeast Florida. It's the third restaurant for the Bravo Top Chef winner. Kevin Sabraga joins us now with more about his culinary vision and the evolution of our local dining scene. Kevin Sabraga, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And it's good to meet you. It's exciting to see your place opening up. There's been so much anticipation.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Sabraga Dining is excited to be here, so it's all pretty awesome.
Now, the opening is your third new restaurant. There was a lot of fanfare. How do you feel everything went with the first week?
The first week has been fantastic. We've been very well received and welcomed. Jacksonville is a great city. It's just great to be a part of this community, especially at this time.
Why at this time? Because it seems as though the food scene is really starting to blow up.
And that's exactly why. The food scene is emerging. And, you know, it's awesome to be part of something at this level. I haven't done that before. In Philadelphia, it's, you know, the food scene has already been there. And to see what's happening in Jacksonville right now, it's really exciting.
Is that the excitement for a chef like you? As I mentioned, you won, I think it was season 7 of
mm-hmm,
Top Chef.
That's correct.
In a big northern metro like Philly, I guess it can be kind of hard to stand out. In a city like Jacksonville that's just coming into its own, you can really make a huge impact.
Yeah, I mean, in Philadelphia, there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of history, a lot of culinary history. We are definitely one of the pioneers in Philadelphia. I think the thing that, for me, what's really exciting about Jacksonville is that it's a new environment. It's part of the South. It's something different. It's something new. And I get to get away from the snow every once in a while.
Exactly. And what you've done, too, is you've got a really modern, fresh twist on the sort of traditional Southern flavored cuisine.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that we did not want to do was do typical Southern food. We wanted to embrace and respect and really pay homage to the ingredients here in the South, and more specifically to Jacksonville, and just not recreate something that has been done before. We have a restaurant in Philadelphia that is traditional Southern comfort, and we did not want to do that here in Jacksonville.
So you went in a completely different way.
That's correct.
Southern comfort in up north must seem so exotic and cool.
It is.
It doesn't make a big impact down here, does it?
No, yeah. The impact down here would be very little impact.
Right.
If I did another mac and cheese, that's great, that's cute. But, you know, you can get that at home. In Philadelphia, you really can't do that. Where here, it's, you know, we wanted to take the beets and roast beets and just treat them really well and not just do a pickled beet salad or something like that, but do something different. So it's dishes like that. It's really about the ingredients.
And you've got a raw bar, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, and so we approach the raw bar differently as well. It's not just raw seafood, but we have two raw vegetable dishes, and we have, you know, a raw meat dish, a carpaccio. And so really just the concept or the idea of raw rather than, you know, shrimp cocktail.
Not only that, you're in the new Unity Plaza in this resurgent Brooklyn neighborhood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How does the location play into your success, do you think?
Well, I think that totally plays into our success. And I know that is one of the reasons why I'm here is, you know, I was here 18 months ago and I saw a big pile of dirt and, you know, concrete building and said, yes, this is something I want to be a part of, because it wasn't built up. There wasn't something there existing. This is something new, and to be a part of something new, and again, being at that ground level is really amazing.
So the restaurant's open now.
Yes.
Anything exciting for the holidays in particular that we should be looking toward?
You know, right now we're still like a baby calf getting our footing, and So right now we're just focused on everything that we're doing and starting out our menus. Obviously, we're offering lunch and brunch and dinner, so that's really our focus through the year, and then come next year, early next year, we'll do some more fun things.
You're here in the winter months, right?
I'm here as much as I can be.
But in the summer, are you skedaddling?
In the summer, I'm somewhere cold. I got down here in August, and it was so hot. I mean, just walking from one spot to another, I was completely drenched.
That doesn't work for a Philly guy, does it?
Well, it gets pretty hot up there, but the humidity down here is a different ballgame.
It can be tough. Yeah, it can be tough.
Definitely.
But it's so exciting to have you in our city. It's exciting to have a new addition to the local restaurants and bars. Scene, by the way. There's a great bar scene at your place as well.
Absolutely. We really wanted to be able to focus on the cocktails and be able to focus on beer and wine as well. And so far, it's been, again, well received.
It's Saraga and Company, now open in the new Unity Plaza in Brooklyn. That's along Riverside Avenue.
That's correct.
He is Top Chef winner Kevin Saraga. You'll see him around town.
Yes, you will.
Celebrity chef Kevin Saraga, it's a pleasure to have you in studio, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And I'll be coming, maybe even today for lunch.
I'll be there. Come see me.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. Questions or comments, just go to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on the Diane Rehm Show, a look at the week's top national news stories. That's coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.